From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Jana Reese. She's joining us to explain what she's learned about millennial Mormons from this big study she was a part of. Reese has gone through the data and is now able to add some facts to the dozens of opinions. Millennial Mormons, she says in her book, still believe, but they're often more flexible about the rules than previous generations. Some things will confirm your own suspicions, but some things just won't. We'll be right back.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For more than a year now, the historian Jana Reese has had to tell people to be patient. Reese has been processing the data from a large study conducted in 2016. It's called the Next Mormons Survey. And people have been dying to know, how are millennial Mormons different from Latter-day Saints from other generations? Are these young adults more likely to accept same-sex marriage? Do they think of their leaders differently? Are they Democrats or Republicans? Why do they stay? Why are they leaving? Well, Reese's book is out now, and while she's careful about drawing any tidy conclusions, she can tell you in percentages how many millennials are certain Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, 51%. She can tell you how often millennial Mormons pray, 65% do every day. The survey tells her how many watched rated R movies or wear temple garments or drink coffee. And for those who left Mormonism, she has a good idea why, because she asked them. The number one reason, they could no longer reconcile their personal values and priorities with those of the church. Number two, they stopped believing there was one true church. Today in the program, Jana Reese is joining us to talk about what she's learned about Mormons from the study and what it might mean for the current condition of the church and its future. The book is called The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. Jana Reese is a religion scholar and a senior columnist for Religion News Service. She's in Utah this week talking about the book. We'll give you details on some of the events a little bit later on the program. As I understand it, you were thinking about, gosh, I want to look into Mormon childhood. And one thing led to another, led to another. How did you get to this point?
Yes. So in part because I grew up in a non-religious family. I'm a Latter-day Saint now, but I wasn't when I was a kid. I was always fascinated by my friends who had grown up Mormon and their childhood experiences, everything from family home evening to seminary. And I wanted to find out which of those practices would lead to greater retention and greater religious activity in adulthood. I also read a fascinating book called The Next America. So you can see the title, The Next Mormons, is a bit of a riff off of this book by Paul Taylor. It basically looks at the demographic changes happening in America over time. And I saw many resonances and points of contact between that data and what I was observing more anecdotally within the Mormon experience. And so that was the seed of the idea instead of looking at generational change within the church.
Who's this about? Because we see information not only, I think people are going to focus on the Mormon millennial bit. And it's true, we get some insights about them. But this is also about the way Gen Xers practice Mormonism in many ways and the way older generations did. The differences, the way they're connected. So it's not just about millennial Mormons. Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say. And I'm glad that you brought that up because I felt guilty as a Gen Xer that it's kind of the forgotten generation in the book. Gen Xers in the data are usually closer to millennials in their attitudes and behaviors than they are to older Mormons. So some of the changes that we attribute to millennials actually began earlier than that. And you can see that trending in the data.
What are you seeing in terms of the way people are talking about this information, not just the specifics of your study, but disaffiliation? I mean, what in the Mormon blogosphere, it, among former Mormons or disenchanted Mormons, what is it that you hear? Because it seems like here's where we get to these kind of preconceived narratives.
Mm. I like the word narratives because I think that all of us have cherished narratives about the Mormon experience, or if you have left the church, the ex-Mormon experience.
Yeah.
And we all have a tendency toward a confirmation bias that our own experience may be normative for others. And that's why we need data. There are plenty of things in this book that people will find that confirm their own opinions. And then there are going to be things that people are surprised by. I was certainly surprised by a number of things. And I try to be very transparent about that in the book.
How do you describe your personal biases, your personal impression? Did you have a sense that something was going on within Mormonism that you may have noticed yourself, you may have personally felt yourself, that was amiss? Because that is one of the findings. Mormonism is losing, in troubling numbers, its young people.
Right. And that is something that I could see just purely anecdotally in my stake in Ohio, that we were losing young people, we were having empty pews. And so the question then becomes, how widespread is this?
Yeah.
Is this simply because, you know, we're not in the center of Zion? Is it because we are only, you know, less than half of a percent of the religious culture in Ohio?
Yeah.
So all of those factors have to come into play. It turns out that nationally, Mormons are, in fact, losing adherents, and particularly rapidly with the younger generation. So the statistics that I present in the introduction from three separate sources, we're looking at anywhere between a 46% retention for millennials to about a 62% retention for millennials. But we used to retain more like 3/4 or even 80% of people who grew up in the faith. So that is a significant drop. And
let me underline those numbers. So it used to be that Mormonism was able to retain about 75%.
Yes, of people born before 1943.
Those are fairly good numbers. Right now, it's about 46, or just a little bit more than that.
Well, the 46%, I'm glad you mentioned this, because the 46% is based only on millennials in the general social survey, and it's a very small number of millennials. When you combine, though, in the GSS, the millennials with Gen Xers, you get 57%, which is not great, right? That's a larger sample. It's a more reliable number. But the important thing to remember is that the trajectory is definitely heading downward. And frankly, given the research that's going on about Generation Z and religion, so this is the generation that's after the millennials, having higher rates even of disaffiliation, less interest in religion, this problem is not going to go away anytime soon. So it is a bit alarming.
We need to also point out, which you do in the book, the context of the broad religious landscape. This environment, as you put it, of widespread religious disaffiliation is happening not just in Mormonism. It's happening in most religions. And it's also true that Mormons weren't that unique when in this incredible boom went on after post-war period through the 1980s. Mormons were growing like crazy, but so was everyone else. So you're putting it in this context, I think, is important.
Thank you. I think that that is a very important context. We, as Mormons, I think, liked to focus on the miracle growth that happened after the war, and particularly in the 1960s to the 1980s, as a sign of God's favor. So if that's your theology, you're going to have to rethink what God is favoring, because, you know,
He favored a lot of people.
It's not necessarily sustainable.
Yeah.
And it's good to remember that religion in America is a big picture. And Mormonism is 1.5% of the religious landscape more generally. We are very affected by what goes on around us, whether, as you say, after World War II, religion is surging nationally. We see this with Roman Catholicism in particular. We see it also even with mainline Protestantism, which then had a decline after that. But then we are now participating in the same decline that is affecting everybody else.
Yeah. I did want to ask this, though. As far as you can tell, how many of these issues of disaffiliation are unique to Mormonism in this sense? Like, related to the truth claims that are very unique to Mormonism, related to the church's particular stance on LGBT couples, which not entirely unique, but there was a very distinctive polarizing moment in November of 2015 that's distinct to Mormonism. I'm not sure if it's distinct to Mormonism, feeling judged in ward situations, but that seems to be an issue. How much of this could be unique to Mormonism, as far as you can tell?
Some of it is certainly unique to Mormonism. Some of the specific doctrinal issues, historical issues with the Book of Mormon, for example, Joseph Smith as a prophet, we found that there was a drop in certainty generationally among Mormons about Joseph Smith as a prophet.
Yeah.
Some of it is specifically Mormon, but some of it is this larger landscape. We have a situation in America now where it is socially acceptable to not have a religion in a way that it really wasn't two generations ago.
Yeah.
Two generations ago, if you had questions with Joseph Smith, you might have kept them to yourself and continued going to church, because if you didn't, your business would suffer. Your children would not have friends. Mm. Do you see? And when you reach a certain tipping point in a culture in which disaffiliation has become more normalized, then you're going to see a surge in other disaffiliations.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about how polarizing the research has been. You wrote about this recently, what you're noticing in terms of now that the book is out or the reactions that you're getting. And I think I get how conservatives might be upset by the research. But what about liberals? What are they upset about? You said most LDS church members support that November decision I was mentioning that proclaimed same-sex couples apostates and wouldn't let their kids get into the church. Most are for that.
Yes, a majority.
And most believe it was, in fact, God who wanted to ban black people from the Mormon priesthood before 1978, that it wasn't just misguided men.
In that series of testimony questions, the question about the priesthood temple ban received, I would say, the lowest endorsement of all of those theological questions. But still, it was a majority who either knew or believed that that was God's will for the church until 1978. So, yes, I think liberal Mormons are finding some things in the book troubling. So there's something to alienate everyone
right.
in this book, right? There's something to disconfirm everyone's biases, including my own.
Let me get a few things out of the way. I want to ask you, were LDS church leaders in any way involved in the creation of the book or the survey in any official or quasi-official way?
No, this was entirely independently done, and it's what's called IRB approved, which means it has been approved as academic research with human live subjects. So, this is an independent project.
Did you or anyone tell Mormon general authorities that you were doing this?
Yes. Actually, some private conversations have happened, not with me directly, but with people who have connections like that. I have no idea if that ever went anywhere. So, I can't really speak to that. I think that for me, the concern in doing research like this is to provide information for ordinary people. Hmm. And they may not be decision makers, but they are certainly influential in their wards. They are influential in their families, as seminary teachers, whatever. And this book really is for them. Whatever other people may use it for or do with it, wonderful. That's great.
But it did make me wonder, the skeptic in me wondered if, in fact, the personal part of this, your investment as a Latter-day Saint, wanting the LDS church to figure these problems out, to persist, made me wonder if, in fact, you wanted to make a presentation to LDS church leaders and said, look, guys, this is what I found, and this is things you should consider.
No.
Okay. All right, that out of the way, I want to talk about the study itself, and let's talk about the scope of it. It's a big survey group, more than 1,100 current church members.
Yes.
More than 500 former members. Put that in perspective for us in terms of the studies that you've seen before, the surveys, momentous is how I've heard it described. I mean, epic. In that sense, this is a fairly remarkable sample size.
You know, momentous and epic are adjectives that I would think of with the Lord of the Rings, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what I would typically
I've
think
just
of with social
seen
science.
It described that way. I wondered if you...
That's very kind.
Yeah.
David Campbell said that.
They did.
And he's a social scientist at Notre Dame.
Yes.
That, you know, it's very meaningful to hear that from him. So yes, I mean, that's wonderful. I think that one thing that we need to keep in perspective is that this is one survey. This is one snapshot in time. And even though it is very large, it still doesn't have that longitudinal presence that we would like to see in order to really map generational change. So Benjamin Knoll and I, Benjamin is a political scientist at Centre College who was instrumental in helping with every aspect of designing and implementing this survey. Benjamin and I are hoping to do a follow-up study that will include Generation Z some years down the road.
I want to mention also, and this is significant, because it's a big part of the book, there are included in the book the results of some or all of about, I think there were 63 individual interviews that you did. Just you doing them or you and Benjamin?
I did all of the interviews myself, so that was entirely me. And the interviewees were not the survey participants.
Got it.
So the survey is entirely randomized. I have no idea who was in the survey. But in the interview pool, I was mostly following leads from people who knew people who could speak to certain experiences. And I think that their stories have really enriched the book, and those were meaningful conversations for me.
It made me wonder how to read the book. I mean, in some ways, it's raw information out there for people to process. So can we come to conclusions about it? Like, I want to be able to get the questions right, for example, what inferences you can draw from this raw information. And the oral stories are terrific, but they're only valuable in expressing an anecdotal impression. So you've got a bit of both, raw information and actual story there. And that's an interesting mix.
Well, I had 750 single-spaced pages just of interview transcripts.
Right.
And as you can imagine, only a fraction of that is in the final book.
Yeah.
And so kind of choosing which elements of which people's stories would help us to understand or disconfirm aspects of the data that were not necessarily other people's experiences, I think was a really important part of writing the book.
Mm. Jana Rees. Her new book is The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. She's going to be speaking at Women of Mormondom. That's a conference at Utah Valley University tomorrow and Friday. Tomorrow night at 7, she's giving a reading at Writ and Vision. It's a bookstore in Provo. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Jana Rees. She's joining us to explain what she's learned about millennial Mormons from this big study she was a part of. Rees has now gone through the data and is able to add some facts to the dozens of opinions about young Latter-day Saints. Her book is The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. Rees is in Utah this week. She is going to be at a number of events. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. There are two different stories about young adult Mormons in America that are told in the book. And they're contradictory, but they also happen to be true. So let's go through these two particular stories. They're expressed. One is Jack. Jack is a 10 in terms of belief, and you tell the story right on. He's pretty fully in as a Latter-day Saint, not as strict as some older Mormons, doesn't see leaders, for example, as fallible necessarily, but he's there on Sunday.
He's all in, as he describes himself.
And then there's Emily, grew up in a big Mormon family, very much Orthodox, but her story is different in that her, as you put it, her shelf broke. Compare and contrast these two stories, if you would, Jack and Emily.
So Jack, as you say, is a very Orthodox Latter-day Saint, who is still active in the church. He's a graduate student, 26 at the time of the interview. And he's a returned missionary. He's also married. He married soon after his mission. I think at the time of our interview, they were expecting their second child, he and his wife. Emily is someone who is an eighth generation Latter-day Saint.
Yeah.
So she comes from this long line of people who have been all in with Mormonism. And she says that she had certain goals for her life, one of which was that she would go to university, she would meet her husband, you know, also an Orthodox Latter-day Saint, and get married, and she would be a stay-at-home mom. That was the plan.
Get married in the temple.
Get married in the temple, exactly. Yep. That was the plan all along. And when I interviewed her, she was 34, and that had not happened. So she did not meet the person that she had been told all her life that she would meet. And that in itself was fairly crushing. I think that in the stories of Jack and Emily, you not only see that doctrinal issues are sometimes important, but you also see that life issues are important. Yeah. The church is a very hospitable place for people who are heterosexual, married, on and on. And it is a less hospitable place for single people. There's a chapter on singles in the book. A lot of stories, a lot of very interesting and somewhat surprising data about singles and church activity and church disaffection. So Jack and Emily both represent things that are happening in the LDS church right now. Those who remain are committed. They are believers, like Jack, but many more are leaving. And sometimes, like Emily, she also mentioned LGBT issues as being relevant for her. She couldn't understand the church's position on that issue. And so you see that it's a constellation of multiple factors.
Let's talk specifically about millennials in this section. Now, most say, and this is not surprising, that they believed in God. But what else is interesting? I mean, they believe, for example, that Jesus Christ was literally resurrected from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a belief in divinity. But I'm wondering, is their sense more fluid than maybe older generations that might have more orthodox, more literal ways of believing?
Well, certainly there seems to be less certainty and dogmatism about these beliefs. So take that question about belief in God.
Yeah.
Very standard. Multiple previous surveys have ascertained that Mormons are strong believers in God, and our survey was no different. 9 out of 10 Latter-day Saints say that they believe in God, and among millennials it was no different.
Right.
That was the same. But when you ask that question on a sliding scale, where the top answer is, I know and I'm confident that this is, that God is real, all the way down to, I know and I'm confident that this is not true, millennials were less likely to choose that first option for many of the theological questions that we asked. Some of them did. And when you add together the people who chose the top two options, either I know or I believe and have faith that this is probably true, then their faith looks great. But it's that drop in certainty that is interesting. There's a table in the book that maps some of these questions. You know, Jesus Christ's literal resurrection from the dead. Millennials had a 26-point drop in certainty, not belief, but certainty. So that's an interesting change.
I wanted to ask you about the doubters who stick around. This was particularly interesting, and this gets us to a woman named Catherine. And Catherine's story is interesting because she starts at some point, as a lot of Latter-day Saints, I expect, do, going online, looking at some of the questions of the truth claims of the Mormon Church's history. And it starts to raise these doubts, maybe doubts that she already had in the back of her mind. And at some point, she stops believing. She stops a literal belief in those truth claims, but she still goes to church. Now, you also mentioned she's unusual, but would you talk a little bit about where Catherine is? Because I'm interested in where you think doubters fit in the scheme of things.
It's hard to be a doubter and remain in the church. Catherine's story is unusual. our findings were that only 17% of people who still identify as Mormon had even a moderate degree of doubt.
Wow.
Not even a lot of doubt, but just some doubt. So that means that really 4 out of 5 Mormons who are sitting in the pews don't doubt, or at least won't admit to it on a survey.
Do you think that's unusual for religions generally?
It is, yes, compared to what we know about respondents who answer similar questions from other religions. Yes, this is a very high degree of belief and a high degree of certainty, regardless of what I just said about millennials in general. They're way more certain than Catholic millennials, for example. So that's an interesting finding. Now, Catherine, as I said, though, is unusual because she was committed to remaining in the church. She found that it was helpful for her children. She thought that the church justified its role in her life because of the good works that it performed, the community that it provided. There were reasons for her to stay beyond theological belief.
Yeah.
But she's unusual.
I've heard people say that they're in it for the ritual, they're in it for the community, they're in it for the comfort of singing hymns. But in terms of belief, they're not really in it for that. That's not why they're there. And it raises this, you often heard the term cafeteria Catholic, and you hear it applied in some ways to Mormons, although less because it doesn't seem like you can be just pick and choose what you want to believe. Where are millennials in all of that? Are they feeling like they can pick and choose the things they want to believe?
It would seem that more millennials are open to cafeteria spirituality than previous generations have been open to that. In fact, this is something that has been explicitly discouraged from the pulpit in General Conference. And so the fact that millennials seem to be choosing some aspects of the faith, like their home and visiting teaching rates were fantastic. Their rates of sharing the gospel with friends and coworkers and family members, those were the highest of any generation.
Wow.
Yes. Those were fantastic, great findings. And then we have other things, other practices where they're not quite as orthodox as we would expect, given the patterns of previous generations.
I guess that may as well get us to coffee. Right?
You knew we had to get there sometime.
Well, I mean, I think
it is.
Did this surprise you?
Oh my gosh, yes, it totally surprised me. In fact, Ben emailed me specifically that day with a "Did you see this?" As we were going through the data, because we were both quite surprised. Basically,
For those who have no idea what we're talking about, explain the significance of coffee among Orthodox Latter-day Saints.
Right. So coffee has been interpreted as being forbidden by the Word of Wisdom, as a hot drink. And that interpretation has been standard through most of the 20th century into the 21st century. So the idea that millennials on that particular item, we asked them about all of the things that are associated with Word of Wisdom adherence. Those findings were fairly in line with what we were expecting. Coffee, though, to see that 4 in 10, both millennials and Gen Xers, said that they had had coffee recently. And when we cross-tabulated that with who holds a temple recommend and who describes themselves as very active, this included some people who had a temple recommend and also felt that they were very active in the church. That was very surprising because for the few baby boomer and silent generation members who said that they had had coffee, when you cross-tabulate those results, there's very little difference. They're not the ones who hold a temple recommend.
Yep. Coffee is an indicator that they're slightly out. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a surprising finding. I was a little bit gobsmacked.
So what are millennials reacting to with that? I mean, part of this could be that we're in a very coffee-oriented, generation. It seems to me also you could make the argument that it's a rule. It's maybe the one part of the Mormon dietary code that doesn't seem to make much sense. Alcohol makes sense. It's addictive. There's an intoxication factor to it. It can be dangerous and bad for your health. The same could be said for tobacco. Coffee, this is confusing, I think, to a lot of people because it's not the hot drinks thing. People drink hot chocolate and herbal tea. It's not the caffeine thing. At least church leaders recently said it's not. No, it's not caffeine. You can start selling caffeinated cola at BYU. So I wonder if millennials are just like, okay, this doesn't make any sense. I'm just going to sort of make up my own mind about that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I would love to know the answer to that. Unfortunately, there's only so far we can go with data.
Of course.
I can tell you this is what they said about their own behavior, but
you have a hunch?
Well, I think that you're onto something when you are talking about what's going on in the wider culture. Coffee has increased dramatically in terms of how available it is and how much a part of the social experience it is in our culture now versus 50 years ago, for example. So they've grown up in a different time. And I think that that does play a part in this finding.
Obedience and versus conscience.
Mm.
Would you say something about that? Because I thought this was pretty interesting. Mormon millennials are sort of 50-50. Talk a little bit about that, because I wondered if that comes into play in terms of the way they're thinking about, oh, should I wear my temple garments? Is it okay if I have a cup of coffee every once in a while?
Right. So toward the back of the book, there's a chapter on authority.
Yeah.
And in that chapter, I'm trying to trace what I see as a difference between institutional authority and relational authority. Millennials in general have been shown to be less attached to institutions than previous generations. And so that was not terribly surprising to find it also among millennials who are Latter-day Saints. In fact, if anything, they are remarkably attached to the institution of the church compared to people their own age. But compared to older Mormons, there are some significant differences. And one of them is the one that you mentioned, that question, which is a binary choice given to respondents if you are going to follow the Council of Priesthood Leaders, even if you do not understand it, or you are going to follow your own conscience or personal revelation, even if it contradicts what a priesthood leader has said. And so for millennials, it was almost exactly half and half. Mm. Very interesting, because for baby boomer silent generation members, two-thirds said you obey the priesthood leader.
So if they find some cognitive dissonance, baby boomers, two-thirds are going to say, I'm going to go with the leader, even though that doesn't necessarily make sense. Millennials, 50-50. They're thinking, no, 50% of them are saying, no, I'm going to go with my own gut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Well, that's what we found. And, you know, to inject a little bit of personal opinion about that, I saw that and I thought, well, right on. You know, we need both kinds of people to have a robust and really healthy, wonderful church. So that's great. I hope that we were able to keep a 50-50 balance because we're good for each other.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is that Mormon doctrine to most people seems static, but you talk about how it shifts over time. And one of the things that was interesting is you mentioned that there were themes in other times in Mormonism. And you could tell this in part by just looking at the talks in General Conference. So there used to be a lot of talk about the Gathering of Zion. There used to be a lot of talk about persecution. But those, you say, have become downplayed over time. And now we're starting to see this focus, and this makes sense to people who pay attention to Mormonism, on the nuclear family. How well has that gone for
really
the LDS
well.
Church?
Up until very recently, it's gone beautifully. We're talking about very recent history that that's been a problem at all. In that section, I'm drawing upon research from Gary and Gordon Shepherd. Their book, A Kingdom Transformed, is really fascinating reading if you want to know more about how this has changed over time. And one of the things that they point out is that until really World War II, we were seeing themes like persecution. The Gathering of Zion was a very important and persistent theme. Apocalypticism,
right.
Meaning, you know, the end of the world is coming. We have to prepare.
Yeah.
And since World War II, other things have gained prominence. So General Conference, we did not see Jesus Christ until after 1950, coming into the top 10 themes for the decade.
Wow.
So that, I think, is surprising to many church members because we have always known a church where Jesus Christ was front and center. But that actually is historically rather recent. And also the issue of the family, as you say, that becomes more important after World War II. And in that sense, we are seeing Mormonism mirror what's going on in American culture more generally with GIs returning from the war. There's a strong emphasis on getting back to normal, having large families, marriage rates. The median age of marriage actually goes down in this period, which is very interesting. And so Mormonism was quite in line with what was going on in American culture. And it's not until the 1970s, really, that we begin to see this divergence, maybe a little bit earlier in the late 1960s, between what the church is teaching about the family and about the role of women and what is happening in the wider culture. And that's when the shifts begin to happen. And then later on, in the 1990s and beyond, the issue also extends to LGBT rights.
Yeah.
And civil rights, again, in the 1960s and 70s.
So we're seeing, let's just talk about millennials themselves, this emphasis on the traditional family for millennials, they're not as crazy about. They see a broader concept and definition of what family might be. They're far more accepting, it seems, about LGBT couples and people and where they might fit in the scheme of things. And it seems like that has been a significant reason for disaffiliation by millennials? Is that fair to say?
Apparently so. This LGBT issues ranked third in the millennial generation among people who had left the church as one of their top reasons for leaving. So it is certainly emerging as a pretty significant watershed moment for them.
Can you peg it to that November policy?
No. And I'm glad you asked that question, because the majority of people in our survey have left at least 10 years ago. Hmm. Not necessarily the millennials, but many of these respondents who are older, and they do not cite any particular historical thing like the 2015 policy. Only time will tell what the long-term effect of that is, because another thing that we know from the data is that for most people who leave the church, it is not a rash decision. 70% or more say that the decision took them at least 6 months. Mm. So this is a multifactorial issue. It's usually done over a long period of time, sometimes even years, as tensions build up. So this is one of many tensions. And something like the November 2015 policy, we may be seeing the ramifications of in the years to come.
I was interested in the question of conformity and obedience, which you get at in the book. Nearly 60% of millennials find the church's emphasis on conformity and obedience to be either very or at least a little troubling. 26 found it very troubling percent. 30% found it a little troubling. Now, 44% said it's not troubling at all, this attention to conformity. But that 60% number, that seems significant?
It is significant, especially in how different it is from previous generations. Only 12% of the boomer silent generation said that they found that very troubling. So that's a pretty significant difference. Millennials just have a different relationship to authority. And that is, I don't think, something that is simply an age effect. I don't think it's something that is based on the life cycle of the stage that they are in right now that they will grow out of later. I think this is actually a cohort effect that will follow them. And if that is the case, then how might that change the Mormon experience?
Let's talk about temple attendance. There's a section there which is really interesting. A few competing stories there. One from Chrissy, a 23-year-old, loved her first experience at the temple. Carrie Ann, age 25, had a horrible experience, didn't ever want to go back. Talk a little bit about the relationship between temple attendance, the temple experience, because you say millennial Mormons and Gen Xers, it seems, are not as enthusiastic about going to the temple on a regular basis.
The temple data is so interesting to me because there are, I would say, inherent contradictions in how people respond to the many questions that we had that touched on the temple. For example, one of the first questions on the survey was to have people choose from a list of 9 items, 3 of them that were their favorite aspects of being Mormon, to see if there was generational change in what their favorite aspects of being Mormon would include. The temple actually ranked 9th for Gen Xers and for millennials,
Wow. Which
was interesting to me. So something about the temple may not be clicking with those generations. However, when we asked them about the positivity of their first experience of the temple, millennials reported having a very positive first experience, in fact, at slightly higher levels than boomer silent respondents. Millennials also said that they felt better prepared for the temple And that was very interesting. You know,
that
many,
seems counterintuitive, right?
Doesn't it, though?
Yeah.
But many boomer silents came of age and into adulthood and into this stage of ritual life when there was no temple preparation class at all. That was an advent in the 1970s. So compared to what it used to be, the temple preparation today is much better. And I think that our data is hinting that it makes a difference in people's first experience. But to give the other side, right? Millennials aren't necessarily returning to the temple because we have a follow-up question about your temple attendance. And that was very interesting, too. So even if they've had this positive experience generationally, something seems to be a little bit amiss in encouraging them to return to the temple.
And you can't tell what?
No, I'm afraid not. In the interviews, there were some hints, especially from women, about some things that women found troubling about the temple.
That might have been fixed.
Exactly.
Recently.
Yeah. So interesting that a lot of the things that women had referenced in these personal interviews were also things that were addressed in January of this year with the changes to the temple endowment ceremony. So that was fascinating. That's not to say that this research made that difference at all. But rather, these conversations have been happening for years, and the church itself has been soliciting opinions from people about the temple, which is wonderful.
Do millennials feel less guilty about taking their garments off, their temple garments off?
In general, yes. The data on that was not quite, and I see you have it highlighted, don't you?
Yeah.
Yep. I've gotten several questions through social media just in the last few days since the book was released about that finding. So what we were expecting to find was that millennials would be more open to situations in which they would take their garments off. And that was something that I've seen in people's writing about their own experiences of garments. There seems to be a greater openness in talking about garments with the younger generation compared to when I became a member of the church in the 1990s. It was not discussed.
Yeah.
So for the most part, that was confirmed. For example, millennials, 45% of them say that it's fine to take your garments off when you're going to the doctor's office, compared to 35% of older Mormons. It's more often the case that they are approving of taking garments off when someone is doing work in the yard or when someone is ill and has a medical reason for it. The outlier, though, the one that you have highlighted, it cracks me up that you did that, is when having sexual relations. So that's the one that people have been emailing me or contacted me through Twitter and saying, what in the world is that about? Because millennials, actually half of them apparently think that you should keep your garments on during sexual relations. I want to quantify that and tell people to please read the footnote that is accompanying this at the end of the book. I wish now that I had made that in the main text rather than relegated it to a footnote. But when we can cross-reference that data by who is married and who has had sexual experience, the people who are responding to that question about garment wearing maybe being something that you would want to do during sexual relations are apparently the people for whom sexual relations are still hypothetical.
This is really a critical part of the story, and that is what you're learning about gender, about women. You write this in the book, Mormonism is sometimes at odds with recent shifts that have taken place in American culture related to the role of women. You say that Mormon women are more religious than men.
Yes.
But importantly, you say women's certainty flags only with questions of exclusion. So they're all in, but when you start leaving them out, then you
Well, and not just them. That's the interesting thing. For women, it's also when you are dealing with LGBT issues, and it's also when you're dealing with race. So that's when they have parity with what men think rather than being much more religious than men, or at least modestly more religious than men. So it's an interesting question because in some ways, Mormon women are coming to resemble other women in America more than ever before. So in areas like fertility, we're seeing smaller families than we did even a generation ago, certainly three generations ago. We are seeing the education levels of Mormon women rise as more obtain a college education. That's certainly changed. And we're also seeing more women working outside the home. Mm-hmm. So in all three of those areas, Mormon women are coming to resemble more like their counterparts. There are still some differences. But Religiously, they are far more religious than other women in America. They are also more Orthodox than Mormon men on most theological issues, and particularly on issues of behavior like word of wisdom, pornography, a lot of different key components.
One of the things you've said is that for a number of the women you talked to, the only place that they actually felt discriminated against was at church.
Yes, I heard that several times.
What do you make of that? Because I think it's interesting. How many women, for example, are bothered that they don't hold the priesthood?
Well, generationally, there is a shift on that question.
Yeah.
So the question is, are you troubled by the fact that women do not hold the priesthood, or that sometimes bothers me? I want to point out that the wording of the question, it is not about advocacy. It is not being an agent for change or saying women should hold the priesthood in the church. It's how do you feel about it? Are you sometimes bothered by this? Are you troubled by it? So only 24% of the boomer silent respondents said that they were bothered by this at all. 59% of millennial respondents said that they were bothered. So it's tipped over into that majority status in which for millennials, as they look at the church compared to the wider culture, then they're seeing this gap.
One of the things that you presented to respondents to the survey were the reasons for leaving. And you have this, and you ranked them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the principal reasons that women left Mormonism is that they felt judged or misunderstood.
It was number one,
for
women,
right.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is interesting. And generally, it was right up there in the top five, I think, for others as well. This idea of feeling judged, this judgmental component of that faith, that seems significant in terms of the numbers or the way people are feeling?
It does. It seems quite significant. It also tied for number one among millennials as a generation. So that is significant as well. It's very interesting generationally and in terms of gender that judgment appears to be pretty important in people's feeling that the church is or is not a hospitable place for them.
And that seems like one of those things that's going to be difficult to fix if you're a church leader.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, it would involve a pretty major cultural shift.
Several decades ago, there were a couple of studies that you've referred to, books, that made these prognostications about where Mormonism was headed. One, Rodney Stark, was pretty optimistic.
Very, yes, optimistic.
Another, Thomas O'Day, saying that Mormonism was not going to be as vibrant. And you write about this in the conclusion of the book. And neither of them got it right. But one person has. And so I want to just talk a little bit about what you've noticed. This gets us to this concept of the angel in the beehive, Armand Moss. Talk a little bit about this, if you would.
Sure. Well, first, let me explain a little bit about those other two theories.
Please do.
The Rodney Stark idea was he was looking at data about how quickly Mormonism had grown since World War II. And so in the 1980s, he is looking to the future and projecting that there are going to be, you know, this quarter of a billion Mormons in the future, that it will be the next world faith, is how he described it.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're looking at far more modest. We're sitting with 16 million people on the rolls of the church. That's not necessarily who considers themselves to be Latter-day Saint still.
And in the United States, treading water mostly, right?
Right. In the United States, our growth rate was about 0.75%, which is exactly the population growth of the United States. So treading water is a good way to describe it. The other theory is earlier from the 1950s from Thomas O'Day. This was a profoundly influential book, and it was really the first time that a big-time social scientist paid attention to Mormonism. He came to Utah. He did interviews. I would point out that he did not interview a single woman for this, which I don't talk about in the book, but I'm writing something about that right now. And I think that it makes a difference because he is looking ahead and thinking, oh my gosh, this faith is going to have a collision course with modernity, and when people become more educated, they will lose the faith. Precisely the opposite happened. And in part, that's thanks to women, the people that he didn't talk to, right? Women are
right.
More orthodox.
Yeah.
So
counterintuitively, the more educated, the more firm into the faith they are.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So we did find that there's a correlation, a positive correlation between a college education and higher orthodoxy. Yeah, so let's get to the theory that I love, that I keep coming back to, which is Armin Moss's The Angel and the Beehive, which is a book that's now 25 years old, but I think will stand the test of time, because he is trying to say that throughout its history, Mormonism has gone back and forth between assimilation and retrenchment. Assimilation and retrenchment. Do we want to be part of American culture? Yes. We also want to retain our own distinctiveness. We want to remain a peculiar people. How do you navigate and find that optimal tension with the host culture in which you are a part? And I see that happening all the time with Mormonism in America. And it's a moving target. That's what makes it so difficult. So, you know, my conclusion in the book does not offer any prognostications about what's going to happen in the future, other than my worry that it will...
Some will stay and some will go.
Yes. And the people who are staying are going to be the ones who are the most orthodox and who most fit that mold.
But that concerns you because that represents what you call this echo chamber, that the church is going to become an echo chamber of its own making. And kind of like inbreeding, that's not so good, it seems like. That's your impression, that this is not going to be good for Mormonism if you don't have that tension. You describe it as firm and elastic. If you don't have
a healthy religion, should be both
firm and
elastic.
Yes. So if you don't have that tension of people pushing as opposed to just believing blindly, maybe that's not a fair way to put it, that you're not going to have as vibrant or as healthy a faith. Is that right?
Right. However, it's easier said than done to try to create that atmosphere. It's very, very tricky. And one thing that we haven't discussed, that, you know, this book focuses on research in the United States.
Yeah.
However, this is a global religion.
Of course.
And so if you are in the headquarters in Salt Lake City, you're not just trying to resolve this tension with American culture. You are also trying to resolve it with Kenyan culture and, you know, the Filipino culture. You have to think globally in today's world if you want to be a 21st century religion.
Jana Rees. Her book is The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. Rees is in Utah this week. She's going to be at Utah Valley University tomorrow and Friday, taking part in a conference there called Women of Mormondom. She's also giving a reading in Provo tomorrow night at the Writ and Vision bookstore. That's at 7 o'clock. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show's produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.